stand on guard for thee. God keep our land.
Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Third Degree Burn. My name is Brian Hughes, and I'd like to welcome you to our show with my friends here. Who do I got here? I've got Tim Elliott. Say hi, Tim.
Hello.
Kurt Greenfield.
Good evening.
And all the way from the other side of the world. Well, not that, not too far over there, but far over there. That's to the east, the far east. Nigel Spink. Say hi, Nigel.
Hello there. Hi.
And how's everybody doing?
Pretty good. Got my good beverage right here.
I'm just drinking water. So, Nigel, what do you typically drink when you're doing one of these?
Usually water. Yeah. Just to clear the throat.
And Tim, hey, what are we doing today?
Well, today is, we are continuing our lead up to Alpha Flight. And the listeners, have been exposed to one episode already. We did X-Men 109, and we're going to do this episode. We're doing X-Men 120 and 121.
Wait a minute. X-Men 120, 121. Didn't we cover that before?
We covered this, just you and me, way back in 2016 in Third Degree Burn episode 12 and 12.5.
I get it. Fresh minds, new ideas.
That's right. Well, the Third Degree Burn family has grown since then. So
yes.
Instead of just re-releasing the old episode, we wanted to get Nigel and Kirk's feelings on these two issues. So,
and in a couple of years, we'll get John and David to do one.
Right.
Or next week. Who knows?
Yeah. So, as I said, this is our stepping stones to doing Alpha Flight proper. So after this episode, we will follow it up with X-Men 139 and 140.
Wendigo.
That's correct. The Wendigo. And then we'll get into Alpha Flight issue 1, and we'll continue that. Similar to how Kirk and I did Namor. So we'll do it numerically.
All
so
right.
I think you have, well, I want to say welcome back, Brian. You have not been in the show in a while because you've been busy with life and all. So it's good to have you back.
I got my daughter married off, so that's a lot check, off our plate.
Check that box.
Yeah,
and I should have money for comics.
What?
Money for comics.
I got a son getting ready to go to film school, so I'm never going to buy another comic, probably for the rest of my life. I do have a small product review. I want to give to you guys. I feel incredibly strong about this. Earlier today, I was at my local grocery store, and I just happened to see in the drink rack a new flavor, a haunted apple flavor made by Fanta to go along with the new Beetlejuice movie, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. Mm-hmm. Wait, I just said it three times. Oh, crap. Anyway, so they've got this haunted apple flavor, and I love apple and green apple. It was a nice green color and everything. And I really have to say, it tasted just like something Beetlejuice would have thrown up. So if you really want to try something disgusting, run out and try this haunted apple Fanta soda. If you just prefer something that tastes good, try something else. This stuff is disgusting.
So that's not five stars.
Oh my gosh! It's like I'm trying to figure out what the hell they were thinking of. It was kind of like a mix, but you could tell there was a little bit of apple in there, and the rest was a flavor like one of those candles that's supposed to smell like creme brulee, but it's overly sweet and just. I mean, Chris smelled it and just started yakking, and it took him 5 minutes to calm down. He didn't even drink it. I drank it. No, God.
Well, to peel back the covers a little bit, we are recording this at the end of August, so the fall season is creeping in, and we had our first. And I picked up my wife from the airport last night. We had our first pumpkin spice latte at Starbucks.
pumpkin spice.
I have something to contribute to this beverage review.
Yep.
This is nothing new. If you're in the United States, you've probably seen this in the healthy foods, healthy juice aisle. But somebody bought something called was it Blue Machine? I think it's Blue Machine. It tastes like a purple pear, as far as I'm concerned. A little bit thick. It's pure juice. It's in the healthy aisle. I think it's pretty expensive, too. More so than your average, beverage. But, boy, I've been enjoying it this weekend. I'm going to have to replace that bottle because somebody's going to be upset when they discover how much I've had this weekend. But I believe it's not Blue Crush. I believe it's Blue Machine is the name of the product. And it's a particular flavor. There's probably, I don't know, 6 or 7 different flavors with different colors and different fruits involved. But this was very tasty. So my recommendations, if you haven't tried it. And Brian, I was thinking about your beverage. I'm wondering if maybe you got a hold of a bottle that had gone bad. I've not had it, and I'm not going to. But I can't believe that they would put something out that was that offensive.
Come on. We actually live in a world where there's a product out there that is known as Soylent Green.
Okay.
And that's like a health drink. Mint flavored.
Okay.
And I don't know what these people are thinking. And again, this is a Halloween thing in line with that Beetlejuice.
Maybe it's supposed sequel. To be bad.
Why would you
I
do that?
I can't imagine. Why would you do that? Why would
I don't, you, I, mean, okay, I agree.
There was an intentionally turn off your customers and burn them. Well, that
you know,
make sense.
You can get the Birdie Bot's every flavored beans out there as Jelly Bellies. Mm-hmm. And they've got the booger flavor, the vomit
flavor, yes.
Dirt and grass and all that. Then they've got the incredibly hot flavors and whatnot in there. So it's a mix of that. And people still buy them today because it's like prank food. You know, you like giving them out to somebody else saying, go ahead and try this. But this thing, you open the lid and you smell it and you know something's wrong. I still had to try it just because, well, you know, I spent $2 on it, but. Good gosh.
I wonder if it has a role in the movie, that if you see the movie, there's like, you know, Birdie's every flavor beans, that it plays a role or that it's side lit in the movie that it will make more sense.
There may be people out there that actually like this flavor, though. I mean, just like those creme brulee candles that you can buy at the grocery store. It is such a sickly sweet smell. I think that's probably what they smelled on Star Trek in that episode, The Obsession.
good point. Good.
Yeah, comparison. You know, it's people buy those things because they keep selling them. So I have to assume that people do like. I mean, come on, people like coconut. I hate coconut.
You don't like the new? Have you tried the new Dr. Pepper coconut cream?
There's nothing in that sounds like anything I like.
It's Dr. Pepper coconut. It's actually pretty good. Yeah.
I don't drink Dr. Pepper.
Okay, mental note on the side. Christmas presents for Brian. Coconut flavored anything. Okay, go ahead.
No rice, no eggs, no coconut, and no seafood.
That's serious.
I could tell you stories for hours, but we don't have time to go into that. We've got to get into comic books.
All right. We have 2 issues to burn through. So I am taking the first issue, 120, and Nigel is going to take issue 121. Mm-hmm. So are we ready to get to the particulars?
Absolutely.
All right. Mm-hmm. As stated, we are covering Uncanny X-Men number 120. This has a cover price still 35 cents. That's going to change. Our writer plotter is Chris Claremont and John Byrne. Our artist is John Byrne. Our inker is Terry Austin. Our colorist is Glynis Wayne. Our letter is Tom or Zanowski. Our cover art is by Bob Budiansky and Terry Austin. Editor is Roger Stern, and our editor-in-chief is Jim Shooter. This had a release date of January 16th, 1979, with a cover date of April 1979. 32 pages, 17 of which are the story. I'm not going to list all of them, but this is reprinted in a numerous amount of books. Classic X-Men, Marvel Masterworks, X-Men Omnibus, Alpha Flight Omnibus, Alpha Flight by John Byrne. That's the Omnibus, the X-Men Epic Collection. So if you want to find this, there are numerous places you can find this.
I think there's even facsimile editions now.
Mm-hmm. Our other Byrne books at the time, one is Marvel Premiere number 47, which introduced Scott Lang as Ant-Man, which we have happened to cover in our very second episode of Third Degree Byrne. It was a crossover with Back to the Bins. Marvel 2-in-1 number 50, which the Thing goes back in time.
And
fights the Thing. Avengers number 182. He was pencil only on that. And then I found that there was some magazine or a fanzine or something called Comic Reader number 167, I guess, did an article in John Byrne. And I think he did the cover art for it. Couldn't find much more on that one. All right.
The Comic Reader, it was a red cover. And wasn't it a spoof cover? Wasn't he on the cover himself?
I think the cover was him drawing the new X-Men in the old X-Men costumes.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I got to double check. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead. Continue on.
Oh, Uncanny X-Men number 120. A story is entitled Wanted, Wolverine, Dead or Alive. Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. Superhero known as Vindicator, formerly Weapon Alpha, meets with the Canadian Prime Minister to review footage of the X-Men's battle with the Mandroids in Japan. See X-Men number 118 and 119. The PM demands that Wolverine be captured and forced back into service for the Canadian government. Vindicator promises he won't let him down as he did after his first failed attempt to capture him. See X-Men 109. Vindicator sends an alert out to 5 very special people, members of a new Canadian-based super team called Alpha Flight. They are Northstar, Shaman, Snowbird, Sasquatch, and Aurora. Meanwhile, in Japan, the X-Men bid farewell to their ally Sunfire, who is thankful for the group's aid in stopping Moses Magnum. Before leaving, Wolverine says goodbye to Mariko by presenting her with a white chrysanthemum and telling her his real name is Logan. The X-Men take a private plane back to the States with Colleen Wing and Misty Knight. But as it passes by Alaska, the plane runs into a turbulent weather all along the west coast. The pilot alerts Scott, noticing that he and Colleen have been very chummy over the last bit of time, and that they have fallen asleep in each other's arms. Aurora awakens and senses something wrong about the storm. She tries to use her weather control abilities to rectify it, but she can't. She realizes some intelligent force is directing the storm, resisting her. Meanwhile, Wolverine also awakens and becomes aware of the situation. Pilot is forced to set the plane down in Calgary. Those on board the plane are unaware that its emergency landing is anticipated there and that a very special operations team awaits them. They're surprised to see a man on the runway awaiting them. It's Vindicator. He demands to see Wolverine. Cyclops tells the pilot to take off immediately. She wants to comply, but the plane is standing still at full throttle. But now the rest of the X-Men are awake and suiting up. Nightcrawler peers out the window, and through the heavy snowfall, he sees the outline of a large, hairy man gripping the hull of the plane, holding it in place. The same hairy creature hoists the plane in the air and hurls it the length of the runway into an empty hangar. Vindicator chews out his teammate Sasquatch, who apologizes and states he doesn't know his own strength. Vindicator flies towards the plane, but finds it's already been abandoned. The blizzard picks up in ferocity, and Vindicator questions Shaman. He replies that one of the X-Men must have elemental powers like him. Under the cover of the storm, the X-Men sneak away and blend in with the crowd at the airport. Wolverine reluctantly explains that their main opponent is James McDonald Hudson, a.k.a. Major Maple Leaf, was in charge of putting together a team of Canadian superheroes, and his earliest recruit was Wolverine. He was out in the field while the rest of the team was being assembled and doesn't know them, apart from Hudson, who they are or what their abilities are. Cyclops splits the team up and rendezvous downtown. In a shopping mall, Banshee, Storm, and Colleen have stopped so that Storm can buy some clothes better suited to so she can blend in better with the rest of the crowd and not just be in her X-Men costume. While she's changing, Vindicator tracks him down. Banshee recognizes him as the man who injured Mora in X-Men number 109 and attempts to sonic scream him, only to keel over in pain. He injured himself and when he was fighting Moses Magnum. Genuinely concerned, Vindicator is about to call a doctor, but Storm instead attacks him. Wary of a combat situation in which such close quarters with civilians, he retreats. Cyclops and Colossus sees him speeding away. Cyclops realizes that since many of the Vindicator's teammates are mutants, It stands to reason he has technology similar to Cerebro, able to detect and track mutants. That means while the X-Men thought they were giving Alpha Flight the slip, by splitting up, they only made themselves more vulnerable. Elsewhere, Wolverine is lost in thought about Mirko and an old flame, Cracklin' Rosa, when Sasquatch gets the jump on him, knocking him out and carrying him away. Remaining X-Men regroup. Misty and Colleen have left to get in touch with their lawyer boss, Jaron Hogarth, for legal advice. Cyclops tells his team that the X-Men didn't start this fight, but they're going to finish it, even if it's over Alpha Flight's dead bodies. Continued next issue. Actually, big cliffhanger.
Although, good summary.
Yeah. I didn't write that, so I don't want. I stole that from online, so don't give me too much credit.
Okay.
Okay. First note I have to make, and I probably made this before. That is one gigantic screen they're looking at. On the first page, if you look at that, they're looking at an image of the X-Men fighting the Mandroids. And at the very top left of the screen, you'll see somebody standing on some sort of balcony.
It's a platform or something,
in front of the screen. To just give you an idea of the size of that screen.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's shaped like a TV. It's got that type of... It's not like it's a movie screen. It's shaped more like an actual CRT monitor.
Yep. Unless that's like a shrunken person, you know, really small, or Puck, you know.
No, I don't think so.
That's such a weird perspective to say that.
Maybe it's Smart Alec from Omega Flight. Oh, I'm sorry. That's getting ahead of ourselves. Never mind.
Okay, so who wants to start?
Page 3. Vindicator or Major Maple Leaf, or what's he calling himself right now?
It's Vindicator.
Vindicator is speaking with a caricature of the Prime Minister. Is that Pierre Trudeau?
Trudeau.
Yeah. It's supposed to be.
Okay. I'm not familiar with him, but he's done in such detail, I feel like I should recognize him. And right below him, we see the first use of the call cards for Alpha Flight, the assembled deck of cards, the 5. That will become critical as we get into their series later on.
Hmm.
Looking at their faces also on this... I guess it's the second page of the story. Down at the bottom, the roll call for North Star, Shaman, Snowbird, Sasquatch, and Aurora. Sasquatch does not look, or Walter Lunowski, rather, doesn't look anything like I think he looks later on in the series. It's almost like I think he changes. His physical face changes.
Well, Aurora, I think, looks a little different, too. I think later. I mean, not Aurora, Snowbird. Sorry.
Yeah.
And it's pointed out that they think of at the time of the writing, because I think we brought this up before, Brian, that Alpha Flight was not really meant to be a recurring team. It was just they needed a group of heroes that could fight the X-Men. So they created them.
Yeah.
And I think at this point, Snowbird was considered a mutant because they think of all of them except for Sasquatch and Shaman. The rest are mutants. So at this point, Snowbird was considered a mutant.
I'm pleased to discover, reading the background for each of these characters as they're introduced, I've been to 3 of the 5 provinces that they reference in their backstory here. Mm-hmm. Jasper National Park, Calgary, Northwest Territories, just out of dumb luck. I just got back from a trip up to Alaska, so... I can tell you, it's nothing like they're showing. It's not snowy. It's not cold. Believe me, it was dry and hot. But that's another story.
Well, they had the storm.
Yeah, they had the
blizzard going on as a result.
That's true. I forgot. I thought Snowbird was the weather warper, but I guess it's Shaman who's.
It's Shaman. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he says that's. The storm is kind of tracking him. It's almost like staying with the plane and herding it to where they wanted to land, because they kept trying to land, I think, in San Francisco. Then the storm prevented that. Then we're going to land someplace else, and all the airports were shut down. So that's why Storm can't control it, because Shaman has used something out of his bag to control the weather, which gets to be a problem in the second issue.
Yeah.
And we get a little more. Go ahead, Brian.
Well, no, I'm just, I'll go on record as saying this. I've never been a fan of the name Vindicator. And, you know, after reading about it, you find that I think that Byrne wanted him to be called something else, like Guardian, all along. But it was Claremont that, you know, changed it to Vindicator because he liked the word. And there's a lot of things that Claremont liked to do on a whim, which I think just drove Byrne more nuts every day.
I have a question about the jet plane they're on. It's got a gigantic H on the side of it.
Hogarth.
Hogarth.
The law firm.
Oh.
That's the Jaron Hogarth is the lawyer that also represents Power Man and Iron Fist, as well as the Nightbird Restorations. Is it Nightbird? Or Nightwing.
Misty Knight's
Private
Eye.
Nightwing.
PI department or PI.
Yeah, and Claremont was writing Power Man and Iron Fist back at this point in time. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of cross-pollination. Because as you see, Colleen Wing is a part of the stories here. And that starts all the way back from Iron Fist 15, which was one of the last issues, the last issue of Iron Fist. And it had Byrne's first X-Men appearance, I think. Or was his first X-Men appearance in Marvel Team-Up? I think it was Marvel Team-Up, actually.
Technically it was, yeah. Just a quick appearance.
But there's a lot of characters that seem to cross over. Now, what's interesting is the pilot looks like Gene DeWolf.
Yeah.
Claremont also introduced. Or one of the pirate pilots, not Anne, but the other one. And so if you're following the plot of the X-Men books, this is where you see that Colleen Wing is really putting the full court press on Cyclops, because Cyclops and the rest of the X-Men here think that Jean and Beast died as they're trying to leave the Savage Land, escape from Magneto, his underground lair.
I have something else about that plane. As I've been on jet planes, they're generally straight, long interior cabins, much like the interior of a bus or motor coach. This thing has a very odd sculptured feel to it, as we see at the bottom where Culling and Scott are kind of curled up on a couch. Look at the doors and the walls in the background. They're like...
Yeah.
They're not quite cave-like, but they have that odd shape. And then later on, when the X-Men wake up and start suiting up, they all come charging out of separate quarters. That plane must be huge if it can have, you know, different chambers to the left, to the right, all the way down the...
supposed to be a DC-10, and it is a private jet, so it could have a modified interior. Right.
I have never seen that sort of remodeling job. It must have cost a pretty penny, and it must be heavier than hell.
Rich lawyers like to show people how much money they can spend.
Oh, okay.
Well, according to this, and this is something I know we brought up in our initial coverage of this, Brian, was when Sasquatch stops the plane, and it says that the plane engines generate 150,000 pounds of thrust, and that he picks up, it says the plane weighs 250 tons. He picks it up and tosses it back. And we questioned that because I guess Sasquatch is class 100, but that's still pretty heavy for.
That's actually the heaviest, up to that point, the heaviest object that's been moved by an individual short of Hercules towing Manhattan by a chain. but I mean, it's just, yeah, that was a stretch, and Byrne even, you know, ruffled at that. Because really, nobody's supposed to be like over 100 tons, you know, in strength. For some reason, that's set to be the upper level.
Right. And I think nobody else has been established to have the same power that the Hulk has. That is, his anger increases his strength. So technically, his upper limit may be unlimited. But nobody else seems to have that. So
Right. Like Abomination had a higher resting strength than the Hulk.
Right.
I mean, let's just say that the Hulk's at-rest strength was 100 tons, whereas the Thing was 85. And what they're saying is, like, the Abomination is even stronger than the Hulk by, like, about 15%, except when the Hulk gets angry. And they're saying that Sasquatch here is even stronger than that.
Well, because not only is he lifting the plane, but he's pushing it against the thrust of the, yeah, so he's even applying more strength to it. So again, it might be, and they thought it tied in with him saying, you know, and it's been established that he had just, for this issue, he had become Sasquatch recently. So when he says, I don't know my own strength.
Yeah, well, I think also that Shaman's storm was helping him along.
It could be. But he was pushing, they were going against a headwind, and that could be helpful.
If you want to know prize it, that's what you use.
That's into it.
Because it's just a bit too much. And just think about all the damage this guy did unthinkingly. And just Alpha Flight would get shut down so quick.
Well, and this ties into the 109 issue we covered recently. When Storm is awake and she comes in, she's wearing like a robe or something. And Cyclops says, hey, see what you can do. And she gestures and her robe flares open. And it's obviously she's naked underneath it. And this issue and then the 109 issue, in that one she talked about hating to wear clothes. And she basically feels more comfortable when she's just naked. So I think they're really playing that up, that she's this.
Yeah, as I recall, that was a thing. That was something they were teasing all the fanboys about.
Yeah, could be.
I like the landmarks that they sprinkle in here. The Calgary Tower, I've been there. Doesn't quite look like that, but it's a landmark. The Stampede Gate is going to be a factor in the next issue, not to get ahead of ourselves. And there's something called the Dominion Mall. I'm not sure what that is, but I guess that's probably another landmark.
Yeah, but from back in the late 70s. Because, I mean, this is all well over 40 years ago.
Oh, you're right.
And so things are going to change an awful lot. Airports get makeovers all the time.
I wonder if Byrne was able to deduct the cost of a trip home to do sketches of these landmarks, because they seem to be photorealistic, and he's got a whole lot of stuff that he's dropping here. Sam's Smoke Shop, Cracklin' Rosie's Social Club, something books and magazine, newspaper books, magazine. I just feels to me like maybe he justified the expense of a trip home so he could get some actual on-location artwork. It's been done before.
I think that he had a bunch of pictures from as much time as he spent there.
Could be.
Yeah.
Could be. What did we decide about Cracklin' Rosa? Is that an actual person or an actual place?
That's a Claremont character. And in the when they did the reprints of Uncanny X-Men in Classic X-Men, there was a story where both, I believe, Banshee and Wolverine spoke about their older days when they were doing clandestine work, and they were on two sides of the same incident at Cracklin' Rosa's, at her bar. But I don't recall that Logan and her actually had a romance. She was just the kind of woman that he would go for.
Yeah. Well, it's a play on words. Cracklin' Rosie, as the Neil Diamond song, it would have been very popular at this time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you get onto page 16, there are, two people sitting there at the front of the image in the very middle of the page that are people that Byrne knows. That's when he does something like that, it's typically people that he knows that he'll give them a cameo in his book.
Mm. Yeah, Nigel, we're not talking about that.
Yeah, I'm going to say, is this the one? Yeah, is this the one you thought was
might have been Roger Stern? Maybe.
Yeah, Roger Stern?
With the beard.
Which page are you on?
16.
16.
Middle panel.
Okay, I see. No, I don't think that's Roger Stern to the left. Mm. Doesn't quite. I've met Stern several times. That doesn't quite remind me of him, but I think the Oriental gal to the bottom right, she's too distinctive. That's got to be somebody that can be recognized.
Yeah, I think they're both somebody Byrne knows.
Probably a couple.
Mm. Well, we'll see. There are more people that he knows in the next issue when Nigel covers that one.
Funny, I don't know.
Poor Banshee. He really is being put through the ringer here. He's lost his voice. He screams and doubles over. Where was this leading to? Were they going to take him out of the team permanently?
Yeah, he retires and goes back to Scotland with Moira.
Get the produce.
I mean, the last time you see him in the Byrne era is the Proteus saga.
Right.
And, you know, he stays with Moira after that. And then he comes back when on Cockrum's second run, and he's more like a James Bond type.
Yeah, character. That never made sense to me. But
well, just his scream never came back.
Right.
Yeah, you know, his power never came
until
back.
They brought in his daughter.
And he had spent time, you know, basically as a, well, I mean, they thought of him as a terrorist. But he was basically, you know, doing clandestine work. I don't know for which government.
I think it was like an Interpol agent or something.
Yeah, like that. And so, you know, he would fall back upon that training. And you know, there was a time when Xavier asked him to help train the students. And so there are several times when you see him at the X-Mansion and he's, you know, just being the wizened professor. I always liked that.
I got a question about when they're in the mall. This is when right before when they're shopping for clothes, they stop to shop for clothes for Aurora because I guess she doesn't have anything to wear. And he's thinking to himself, says with her height and hair, Aurora stands out in any crowd. Has it ever been established that Aurora is particularly tall?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that it was established. And then, of course, she's got the big hair, too.
Well, yeah, that white hair, that's going to...
I mean, she's like an Aquanet nightmare.
Yeah. Well, and not to be indelicate, but an African-American woman in the 70s in Canada is probably going to stick out anyway.
Good point. Well, at the bottom, when she unleashes her power, she sort of does a Dark Phoenix reveal... crackling energy behind her, and her hair is flying like crazy. So, you know, she's got a great headpiece. She's got striking white hair. She's tall. She's a black, strong black woman. And until she went into this shop, she probably didn't have clothes that were appropriate for the climate there. So, yeah, I agree with his assessment. She'd stick out any place in a crowd.
Yeah,
but the thing about their costumes is that they're made of unstable molecules.
Right.
So that when they do certain things, like Peter's got something that he does, Storm's got something she does, and it's usually with her lightning, it actually transforms her clothes into her costume.
That's what I thought, because
yeah,
Byrne did that in, was it his Elswynn stories? Because then we talked about that she was able to change from her civilian costume. Clothes into her costume.
Yep.
Let's see. Well, Nigel, yeah. We've just kind of been talking so much. What'd you think?
Yeah. Well, quite a few of the things you've been coming up with, I guess they're things that you're more familiar with, like these places and things, which they didn't really mean anything much to me other than they're somewhere in Canada or somewhere in America or whatever. But one thing, yeah, just going back to what you were saying about the original roll call for the Alpha Flight members, I say, yeah, what you said about Walter Lankowski, he does look a little bit older on that first picture than what Byrne draws him later comics, yeah.
Is that also because he's in a lab coat and tie with the glasses? And
I don't think it's so much because of what he's wearing. It just his face, to me, he looks like he's an older person than later, let's say, in like Alpha Flight 9 and 10. He has a more physical kind of look by then. I don't know whether that's as an effect of becoming Sasquatch so many times. It could be.
That's a good point. It could be like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yeah, to a certain extent.
That's kind of the vibe that I get here. But
and of course, that's before we find out about, you know, what Sasquatch actually is. I'm not saying any more about that. And then Aurora, yeah, well, she's in her Jean-Marie persona there in that picture. So she does look a bit different because she's like, yeah. She's the prim and proper schoolmistress there.
Well, he might not have established that Sasquatch later. He's
Yeah.
He's like a college football, pro football player or a college football player. And then he became a scientist.
Because as you say, they've only been created at this time to fight the X-Men. Nobody's background's been fleshed out much, really. So that's the way we see them at the moment. Yeah. Sunfire saying goodbye to the X-Men there. That was the end of the previous story. Oh, yeah, Mariko. It's fun. I always think it's quite interesting how she changed from her first appearances, because she's the, at this stage, she's the typical Japanese female princess. Yeah. Very kind of demure and like a little flower who needs to be protected and looked after. Yeah.
I was thinking porcelain doll.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Certainly, she changes quite a bit later on in the X-Men title, yeah. To a degree that I thought was a bit too much, to be honest. I don't think she would have ever become like that, but anyway.
In the... go ahead, Nigel, sorry.
And then Wolverine, that's the first time he gives his name, Logan.
Is that the first time the reader, us, the reader, find out that he's called Logan?
I think so, because in the other comic we were looking at the other time when we were doing X-Men 118, 119, he starts to say his name, but he only gets as far as Lo, and then something happens that interrupts them.
So during the Cochrane run, one of the leprechauns referred to him as Logan.
Mr. Logan. Yeah.
102, 103 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. I thought that was the first time he'd given his name. That's the first time he gave.
I think it functions that way, Nigel.
It's the first time he gave his name to Mariko, anyway.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And then, we've got the storm and everything that forces him to land. Oh, yeah. One thing I was going to mention about, like you say, Sasquatch picks up, stops the plane from flying off, and then he throws it. And it's hinted at that he's only just started to become Sasquatch. That's why he says, I don't know my own strength, as if they've not had time to fully test his abilities yet. So in that case, though, how come he gets straight into the first team, as it were? Because I thought they had Beta Flight and Gamma Flight for upcoming super people. But it seems like Sasquatch, as soon as he's able to turn into this creature,
he's the big gun.
He's in the first team.
Well, they needed a strength.
They needed a tank, as they call it in gaming.
Yeah, but
it can also be that he's making an excuse when he says, "Sorry, Vindicator. I guess I don't know my own strength."
Yeah,
that's kind of a toss-off line.
Mm. Okay. He says, "I still don't know my own strength."
If that's the on page 14, if that's the case. They were taking a big risk then, if that's the case.
Yeah.
They were just so.
Yeah, well, they did, yeah. And he wrecked.
I'd love to see Byrne take that thread and run with it. An early, early days of Alpha Flight, a miniseries looking at the development of backstories at a couple of characters. Mm-hmm. Are you listening, JB? Sorry.
Well, Byrne does go to great lengths throughout the whole book to kind of hide Alpha Flight. You just see glimpses of them. You don't get them fully revealed at all.
That's true in this issue. Yeah, you hardly see any of them.
And that's something I want to ask about. Yeah, when I was on page 14 at the bottom, this is after 14. He's thrown the plane.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, first off, the panel where you see the plane crashing is so weird because the actual sound effect, smaram, is hidden. Not hidden, but it's within all the debris.
Yeah.
And I think that's interesting because I don't think I've seen that done really much where it's done like that. So that's definitely got to be Byrne did that himself. That's not a letterer thing.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that's interesting is on the bottom panel, there's a hand sticking up in the air. Is that Sasquatch's hand?
Sasquatch.
That must be Sasquatch.
This is the top of his head on the left.
Although his hand is different too.
Yeah, because
the way it looks.
His page where he's grabbing the plane,
it's
furry.
It's more like a claw as well. Mind you,
his nails aren't long enough.
You can't see much of it because there's a lot of shadow on the back of the arms. Yeah. So he got away with got away with that. But yeah, the hand's more like an ordinary hand rather than a shaggy creature. But yeah, but they were obviously, as you say, keeping him fairly covered up. We don't see his face. But actually, yeah, we do see his face a bit later on in darkness. Yeah. And he's waiting for Wolverine around the corner. Yeah. You get an idea of his face. Actually looks quite creepy there in the in the shadows. Yeah.
Well, look at the next page down, page 15 at the very bottom. You've got all the X-Men and Misty and Colleen and one of the pilots, I think, is there with them. And on the far left is Nightcrawler, who's wearing a hat and his face has disappeared.
Just his eye. Just see his eye. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. And then, yeah, I was never fond of the name Vindicator either, just to mention that. As you say, maybe that was just a Claremont thing that he wanted to do that. I preferred it when he became Guardian. Yeah.
Well, that sounds.
Somebody says at some point that he has nothing to vindicate, and so they change it to Guardian. But what I don't remember when that happens. Is that Alpha Flight 1?
Or is it? I think he's Guardian by X-Men 139.
Yeah, because he was Weapon Alpha in 109. Here he's Vindicator, and he becomes Guardian. And then doesn't Heather, when she, again, I'm jumping ahead, doesn't she take the name Vindicator at one point when she puts the suit on?
I never read that.
So. I don't remember.
I don't remember either.
We'll think it's Guardian.
We'll find out. Guardian's mom. And then Calgary, the tower. I mean, never been there, so I don't know whether it's true to life or not. But
The entrance looks roughly like that.
Right.
It's at least labeled. I can tell you that.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Doesn't Toronto have a tower similar to that?
Yeah, Toronto has a tower,
I was thinking of Space Needle in Seattle.
I was reading when you were talking about her getting, when Storm was looking for her new clothes. And in the narration part, because I thought, aren't we in Calgary? And it says something about barely three city blocks away in a plush boutique on the third level of the Toronto Dominion Mall. And I thought, are we supposed to be in Toronto or Calgary? Or is
maybe
that just the name? Is it just the name of the place, Toronto?
I think it's
Dominion?
The name of the place. Toronto Dominion.
Yeah.
It's probably, Because this is supposed to be. This is Calgary.
It's supposed to be Calgary. So
which is kind of like Calgary is kind of where they have is it the rodeo? What do they have? It's a Western
Stampede.
Town.
Stampede.
That's.
There are more millionaires per head in Calgary than anywhere else in the world because of the interests, the oil interests, and the. Equian interests. I can't recall, but they're pretty proud of that. They make that point every time you visit Calgary. They kind of rub your nose in it.
And then, the battle and Vindicator has to run off again. Yeah, he always seems to be failing. He actually says that about himself, doesn't he? At the bottom of page 26, he says, some superhero and team leader I'm turning out to be. Because he always
always intended for Logan.
He always seems to not quite succeed and has to run away or something like that.
We'll talk about it more when we get into Alpha Flight proper. But he's always kind of been that way. To Brian's point, he didn't want to be the leader. He
he's kind of forced into leadership. That's why they wanted Wolverine back as well, I think. And so, and then just all in all, loved the issue, of course, because I was collecting it regularly by this time. The artwork was very nice. All the usual stuff that we say about Byrne's artwork. Yeah, enjoyed this one immensely. It built up the first part of the story well, ready for the climax appearance of Alpha Flight.
Well, for anybody who ever says Byrne doesn't do backgrounds, this issue is very detailed, and and it's a lot of small panels. There's no big splash pages. There's a couple, when the plane is crashed, it's a big center panel. But for the most part, it's 9-panel grid, 6-panel.
Yeah.
But that was what Byrne did back then. He wanted to cram a whole lot into a book. So his panels were smaller. The camera was further back.
Yeah.
And so you got more detail per, you know, the smaller images. I think like page 27 is a real good example because you get to see, you know, Cyclops and Peter talking, and then you see Logan walking the streets and you see just how much, you know, what Terry Austin is doing there, because there's so much Zipitone used on this page, different types and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And then the thing that he did to the face of Sasquatch, I think that's more Terry Austin than Byrne.
Yeah.
But the Zipitone under the hat, where you see the shadow over Logan's eyes.
On Wolverine, yeah.
And then a different Zipitone used for his coat.
His coat. Uh-huh.
Then the shirt, which has got that plaid pattern to it.
Yeah.
Well, this is kind of Wolverine's typical Western look they put him in.
Yep.
The hat, usually was, I don't know if he'd had a bolo tie, that kind of lamb wool type short jacket. I don't know what it's called, but you know, it's a Western type jacket.
Sheepskin.
There's a lot of Zipitone on Aurora's skirt when she's in the boutique. You see her skirt and the shadowing below her leg. There's Zipitone. I do like the scene where we're talking about Guardian, where it makes him a little more human, where he is genuinely concerned about Banshee. When Banshee tries to scream and then he just grabs his throat and keels over, he
you can hear that. Oh God, it's just
Yeah.
Or if you've ever had strep throat, that's what it feels like. And then he's genuinely concerned. You know, he's going to call a doctor. And before he can do that, of course, Aurora just berates him and then blasts him.
Yeah. And then he's concerned about the civilians, which is why he backs off. And
So there's that image on the top of page 26 where you see basically, is it Vindicator shooting or blowing into the wall and you get the big boom?
Shaboom.
He's being blown out of the...
It looks like Jim Shooter is in that right side of the panel.
Looks a little bit like... Who's the other Alpha Flight guy?
Jeffrey
Madison?
Yes. Looks Madison a little like him.
Jeffries.
I'm sure it's not.
And then, I've noticed on the very last page when you were talking earlier about Aurora standing out, and she's finally got her hair covered up.
Yeah,
right.
She's got it all like wrapped in a scarf type headgear.
So she's and she's not wearing heels. It looks like
she's
as tall as Scott. Scott's about 6 feet.
She's a tall girl.
Yep. Now, is that Turk on the right side of the panel wearing the green Santa Claus outfit? Oh, no, he'd be in Hell's Kitchen.
Yeah.
But who's wearing a green Santa outfit?
Well, I'm reading this right now in the Marvel Masterworks volume, and so the coloring is completely different here. He's just toasty tan or brown. He's not necessarily...
All right.
Which leads me to another comment as soon as we're finished with this issue. Anything else?
I think we're good.
Huh? That's about it.
Except, you know, Cyclops really can rock a turtleneck. If you look at that bottom panel on page 30, last page.
Mm-hmm.
Not only is he got a rock and a turtleneck, it matches his glasses.
Yeah, cool stuff. Yeah.
Well, a last comment I want to make is, what does the Canadian government expect? They keep talking about capturing Wolverine and forcing him back into service. Are they going to use, I mean, how are they going to force him? Like mind control? Are they going to threaten him? Are they going to, I don't know what once they get him back to Canada, what their plan is.
They're going to put him in jail.
Maybe lock him up there.
I guess.
Keep him in a cage.
Yeah.
But then he's not working for you and doing anything for you then. So
yeah, but then he's not enjoying himself, and that's all it's all about.
Yeah, if you want to do that, yeah.
Yeah, he's their
remember,
property.
He snipped the tie of a general. You don't do that. Get away with it.
Yeah. Good stuff.
It's like that guy in the tower at Top Gun. He wants some butts. All right. Now, did y'all have the copy with the Hostess ad?
I do. Yeah, it's Spider-Man.
Yeah, now this does look suspiciously like a Sal Buscema or Keith Pollard, actually. Right. It's the Spidey poses makes me wonder.
Spidey.
And then the secondary character, that photographer, who's very, he looks like an overweight Bob Denver. You know, Gilligan from Gilligan's Island. But makes me want to go downstairs and get a Twinkie.
Sorry, who did you say you thought the artwork was like on the Spider?
I'd say it looks like it's either Sal Buscema or Keith Pollard.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I was going to, yeah.
I mean, they're supposed to make it very generic. So
yeah, it's a bit off in one or two of the panels, but there's a couple of panels where you could think, yeah, it could
be. But you know what? And I forgot about this. Mike's Amazing World actually has a page that tells you who did
the hostess
all the outfits. Yeah. Uh-huh.
If I can get to it. Mm-hmm. Oh, the late, great, amazing Mike Boyles. Hope he rests in peace. He passed away a couple months back. I don't know if anyone here had mentioned it, but
No, I don't think they did. But I remember reading. Yeah, because there was a bit of a mystery about it, wasn't there?
Yeah, because his site even
they didn't know whether this was whether it was true or not at first. And they were all putting out messages saying, please let us know if this is the case. And
I think his daughter put something on the website for a bit that made that announcement. Then they took it off and they said they're going to keep the site up, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's better than the hostess ad, Brian, while you're looking that up, is there is an ad for Full Color Poster Spectacular number 2. You could get the McNichols, which is Christy and her brother, and I can't remember his name, Farrah Fawcett or L.A. Fawcett. I don't know what's that. L.A. Farrah, or a giant Cheryl Ladd, or Linda Carter, or Miss Anton, or Kiss.
Susan Anton.
Or Rolling Kiss.
Girl. July of 79, right?
I just noticed something interesting. The last page, maybe somebody's already commented on this, but the last page, the last image, is Scott basically saying, the X-Men didn't start this fight, people, but we're sure as hell going to finish it. If necessary, over Alpha Flight's dead bodies.
How does he know their name?
Right. How does he know the name Alpha Flight? So I started working backwards here to see if anybody drops it, if Hudson mentions it, if anybody says it. And as near as I can tell, it's Wolverine as he's explaining to them, this is my fight. Why do they want you? And he's like, it's my business, not yours. And they say something to the effect, or as they're coming out of the airport, he says something. I was operational when Hudson gathered the rest of Alpha Flight. Outside of him, I don't know who we're up against or how many. I think that's the only mention.
Yeah.
Well, I'll give you one better. Okay, the sequence on page 10, just before Logan says that, you know, it's stay out of this. Vindicator is standing on the tarmac in front of the airplane, and he's giving them the ultimatum. And telling him he's got 1 minute. How can they hear him?
Good point.
Oh, his suit amplifies it. Come on.
Okay. And it's going over their radio.
Yeah, come on.
Yeah, well, he is electromagnetic. He's probably on their radio frequency, but I agree with you. How does he hear it? Because he's in the middle of a snowstorm. The wind's blowing.
Okay.
Comics.
So this is, I'm finding the hostess ad, but I can't. Okay, put himself in the picture. Let's see if I get some credits here.
Well, Brian's looking it up. Kirk, as a weatherman, how accurate would you say the weather was in that issue?
Oh, well, she's a weather witch. And Shaman apparently has. I thought it was Snowbird who had the weather warping abilities, but they make reference that it's Shaman who's trying to control the storm. For purposes of plot, it's just fine. You know, they get forced down in Calgary. That's good enough for me. Let's move on. Well, I have a comment here if you're still digging for information there. I have a complaint that I want to lodge for Marvel. I've got Marvel Masterworks Volume 24 in my hand, which covers X-Men 111 through 120 by Chris Claremont and John Byrne. This is the gold foil dust jacket, so it's kind of rare. And it was expensive when I bought it. I'm trying to find the price. Yeah, $34.95 US when this came out. These days, they're more like $50 to $75. Nice volume. Rounded out at the end of this particular episode is a like six-page background on Cyclops skills or abilities that was taken from the origin of the X-Men background features that ran in the original series way back when. Okay, nice volume. You go to the next volume in this series, and I'm afraid I don't know the number of that volume, but if you were to pick it up, you would get Marvel Masterworks, the X-Men's number 122 through something else. My argument, my complaint is they never reprinted 121 in this series. And I'm pissed. I paid a lot of money for this. I want my 121. I don't understand how they can possibly make that mistake. And I don't know who the editor of the series was at the time. But that person needs to be reprimanded, if not fired. I won't ask for anybody to be fired. But, man, I don't have the next volume, and I don't have 121. Okay, end of rant.
Yeah, I'm not having much luck on the credits on that. I even found the Byrne Hostess ad, and it doesn't even have his credit on there. We found out later because Roger Stern had put a note on it. But, yeah, it doesn't tell me who did. It just shows me where it first printed. But still, I'd say that's either Sal Buscema or Keith Pollard.
Okay.
Let's move on to...
Shall we move on to the next issue? Yeah.
Nigel?
Okay, yeah. So we are now looking at X-Men number 121. Release date of 13th of February 1979, cover dated May of 1979, and as predicted, a cover price of 40 cents. It's gone up from this issue. Still 12 pence in Britain, and just as an interesting fact, in Britain, this title, X-Men, remained at 12 pence a month right up until issue 134 before it actually went up to 15 pence. So although the Americans put the price up when they did, yeah, we got another year out of it at the same price.
I'm jealous.
Yeah. I was surprised. I thought, oh, I'll look and see if I'd already got it written down that it would have changed then to 15 pence. But then when I went back to look at my X-Men comics immediately after this, I thought, well, wait a minute, still 12p. And I went all the way to issue 134 before it went up. So great stuff. Yeah. Other works by Byrne for the same month, we have Marvel Premiere number 48, The Price of a Heart, which was the second part of the new Ant-Man story, and Avengers number 183, The Redoubtable Return of Crusher Creel, which was the first of a two-parter with the Avengers going up against the Absorbing Man. So Byrne was the artist on both of those issues. Right, creative team. Well, for the cover was done by Cochran and Austin.
But then did you mention who did the cover on the previous issue?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, it was Budiowski.
Yeah.
And Terry Austin.
I'm sorry, Nigel. I had a bad tendency to interrupt.
So what did I say? Oh, yeah, I was on Cochran and Austin for the cover. The creative team inside, writers, Chris Claremont, John Byrne, penciler, John Byrne, inker, Terry Austin, colorist, Glynis Ween, letterers, Diana Albers and John Costanza, editor, Roger Stern, and editor-in-chief would have been Jim Shooter, And the title of this issue is Shoot Out at the Stampede. Now, this synopsis, I've actually based it on the issue of Classic X-Men 27, which was the sort of coverage of the original story. But it also had three extra pages added to it, which add a little bit of information to the story. So I've included those in the synopsis. So here we go. Shoot out at the Stampede. Cyclops, Colossus and Storm blast and smash their way into the locked exhibition grounds of the Calgary Stampede. As they enter, they are watched by a shadowy figure, that's Shaman, who sprinkles magic dust from his bag along the entrance, sealing it off from any other outsiders. As the X-Men search for their missing teammates, Cyclops recalls how Storm suggested she can trace Vindicator's energy trail by following disruptions in the air, which had led them to the Stampede grounds. Storm, having flown ahead, returns to tell her comrades she has located Wolverine and Nightcrawler. Colossus suspects a trap, to which Cyclops agrees he's sure it is. Interlude 1. The Canadian Federal Capital, Ottawa. Jeren Hogarth, respected attorney, demands answers regarding agents of the Canadian government smashing a multi-million-dollar private aircraft. As the official explains that they were carrying out authorized duties, Ambassador Sarazawa of Japan bursts in demanding to see the foreign minister. He has been contacted by the Emperor and ordered to find out why a band of superheroes, recently honored for saving Japan from total destruction, is now being attacked by the Canadian government. Unfortunately, the foreign minister is unaware of this incident, which is referred to as the Weapon X situation. He is not happy. Back in Calgary, as the X-Men close in on the whereabouts of their two captured comrades, they are suddenly confronted by Vindicator and Alpha Flight. At the main gate, Misty Knight, Colleen Wing and Banshee arrive, but find their access blocked by Shaman's magic barrier. Inside, as Cyclops argues with Vindicator, Colossus notices Northstar moving behind Cyclops, and he stamps upon the ground, creating a shockwave which knocks the Alpha Flight members off their feet. This causes fighting to break out, and Wolverine and Nightcrawler, who were both just plain possum, leap to their feet. The members of each team break off to face their opponents, and they seem evenly matched, but Alpha Flight seems to have better teamwork. Shaman creates a blizzard to throw the X-Men off guard, but it seems to grow too strong and engulfs the city. At the top of the Calgary Tower, restaurant patrons John Byrne and his friend Darice must dive for cover when the windows burst inward due to the blizzard's ferocity. Interlude number 2. Ottawa. The US ambassador now joins the Japanese ambassador and attorney Jeren Hogarth, demanding to know what is happening regarding the X-Men and worried about the exceptionally bad weather. The blizzard is growing and covering more of the Americas. There could be snow in the Caribbean by morning. The US ambassador berates the Canadian foreign minister and states that if this is the cost of reclaiming Weapon X, it's too high. The foreign minister finally calls the prime minister. Back in Calgary, the two teams continue to fight each other until everyone is distracted by the intensity of the blizzard. Even Shaman has lost control over it. Storm subdues Snowbird and turns her attention towards ending the wild gale. She manages to dispel it, but as she glides back to the ground, exhausted, A devious North Star punches her from behind. Annoyed by this, Cyclops blasts North Star with his eye beams, then moves in to give him a good beating. But Wolverine, of all characters, stops him and calls a truce. He agrees to surrender to Vindicator if the X-Men are allowed to leave. Vindicator agrees. The barrier across the main gate fades and an armored car arrives. Wolverine climbs into the armored car, ignoring insults from a Department H guard. Next morning, a jet carrying the X-Men is escorted by Canadian Air Force fighters to US airspace. Once the fighters leave, Cyclops asks the team if they want to risk going back to rescue Wolverine, to which everyone agrees. When he enters the cockpit to tell the pilot to turn around, he's amazed to find Wolverine in the co-pilot's chair. Wolverine had escaped, and he states, "The cage ain't been built that can hold me." Epilogue. Alpha Flight joins the Canadian Mounted Police as they clear up the mess of the damaged armored car from which Wolverine escaped. Vindicator gets a call from the Prime Minister, who is not happy with the mission, and rescinds the capture order on Weapon X. He also saves Vindicator with a warning that if having a national superhero team becomes a fiscal liability, they may become a luxury Canada cannot afford. And that's that.
Now, the art those pages was all Kieran Dwyer.
Yes, yes.
And he happened to be Byrne's stepson.
Yeah, yeah, he drew the extra pages, yeah. But I just thought, yeah, it gave some good back information from the Alpha Flight side of the story, which we never had originally. With regard to what was happening in Calgary.
Where did you say the extra pages fell in there?
That's from Classic
X-Men. In Classic X-Men 27. Which
and what does it add to the story?
It gives background from the point of view of the Canadian government of what's happening during the, you know, the story between X-Men and Alpha Flight.
Okay.
And also, it starts with Jerren Hogarth, you know how they damaged his plane in issue 120. So he's wanting to see someone in charge in the government because he wants to sue for damages because it was his plane that they were on. And then, of course, it builds from there when the ambassador of Japan arrives, because don't forget, in the previous issues, X-Men had just saved Japan from Moses Magnum. And so they were like wanting to know, why is the Canadian government now, you know, attacking the X-Men?
Well, is that Gary Cody that's talking to Jerren Hogarth? I'm wondering.
Yeah, hang on. I think it might have said his name, but I didn't put it on. It's in the first interlude. What did they refer to him as if they did?
Oh, Keats.
I don't think they did. Oh,
no,
there's
the last,
a name somewhere, yeah.
Yeah, the last
panel,
the guy says Blastic
Keats.
Keats.
Yeah, Keats. Yeah. Who I don't know who that was, other than just a government lackey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It reminded me a little bit of Gary Cody. But I don't like the coloring job that they did on the classic X-Men print.
Yeah,
of this
agreed.
Movie. It's so much better, less washed out. Mm-hmm. Byrne's little cameo in there with his friend Darius, he's got a really long arm. Is that the one that Lex Luthor wanted to show Otis? Sorry. Couldn't help myself there. And then looks like Paul Kupperberg, and I'm not sure who else, these two other people on page, I got to look at the right book.
17.
Yeah, okay. But yeah, there's three cameos in there. And one of them seems to be Paul Kupperberg. There's Jim, Corey, and Paul.
Oh, that page. Yeah, where am I? Oh, it's page 13 in my... yeah, I thought they must be somebody, but I didn't know who they were.
Yeah. Right. But yeah, I don't recognize
that. Oh, yeah. Well, it mentions Jim, Corey.
Corey, yeah. It's probably friends of Byrne. They're drawn to look like somebody.
Yeah. And then the one I mentioned to you earlier, Tim, when we were talking, it's page 18 in my issue that I'm looking at. It's the next to the last page of the original top panel. You've got the people talking in the background, Misty and Colleen and Banshee trying to get into the stampede ground. And there's a woman walking past in the foreground.
Oh.
And the way it's drawn, that must be somebody Byrne knows, I think.
These must be all his Canadian friends, I would think.
Yeah.
Right. So it's not whatchamacallit, Glynis Ween then, from the, because is she the colorist on?
Mm-hmm.
I wondered if it was either that or a member of the Marvel creative teams or something like that. But I'm sure that must be somebody.
Yeah, my guess is it's Canadian friends, because this is in Canada. So it's probably people he knew when he was living there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, in the extra pages that you have in the classic X-Men.
Yeah.
Does it show how Wolverine, because they put him in this armored car and they say, you couldn't bust loose in a million years. Well, unless it's pure adamantium, nothing's going to keep him in there. So,
Well, he does. Yeah, they say he'll never get out in a million years. Yeah. And in the panels, when they get there, I didn't put it in the actual synopsis, but they're clearing up the mess. And the guard who sort of gave him that comment, he's all wrapped up in metal. He's kind of encased him in metal. And as Sasquatch is freeing him from that, he says, amazing, isn't it, Garson, how quickly a million years passes. But you were right, though. Wolverine was too dumb to know escape was impossible. And then there's a big hole in the side of the armored van where he's got out.
Yeah. I think it'd been even nicer if, because I'm sure, as old as Wolverine is, he's picked up some lockpicking skills for him to get out that way instead of get out like Houdini or something instead of just cutting his way out.
It looks like he just battered and then cut his way out of the side of the van.
Trying to figure out there on page 19 of the issue, the original issue, the second panel's got a facial shot of Aurora. And that looks like somebody, I mean, if she didn't have the hair, she'd look like Annie Lennox. But there's somebody else that she resembles from, today almost.
I can't find it.
Page 19?
Well, it's not 19 on mine.
It's the page where Nightcrawler sneaks up on her and kisses her.
Oh, so maybe that's later than what I'm looking at the moment.
Oh, well, said
Aurora. Sorry, yeah. Aurora. You said.
I was thinking Aurora.
I got the wrong one. I was looking for Snowbird. Sorry. Yeah, no. I got it. Yeah, yeah. She's got a sort of funny kind of sneer on her face.
A smirk. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they all are a little off model. What ultimately they look like when he starts doing the proper book.
Mm-hmm.
Sasquatch is when you first see him that splash page where they're all there. He's a little drawn a little thicker and bulkier than he's drawn. Yeah.
Especially by Kieran Dwyer. Yeah. I was just going to say in that last page where he draws the Alpha Flight, it's not very good. Or maybe it's the coloring that's at fault as well, because there's a picture where they're all there and like, Aurora looks nothing like she should, and it's because she's got white hair on that particular picture, and so has North Star, and they're not white haired, are they, really? Snowbird looks the same, Shaman looks younger than he is.
I think they're supposed to have black hair, but some of these panels, even Byrne's drawn out like they've got.
Yeah. But it's kind of the way he draws it or the way it's been colored when Byrne's doing it. It's just like it's added for the lighting effect.
Right.
But on that last page that was extra in the X-Men classic, both North Star and Aurora have got white hair.
Yeah, artists had a hard time doing it the way that Byrne described it.
Yeah.
So black that it's shiny.
So,
yeah,
it's a bit off. But yeah, like you said, I didn't like the coloring on any of the extra pages that they did. I don't know who was responsible for that, but it was sort of all fadey and washed out.
Yep.
Compared to the original pages, yeah.
It's got to be someone different from the...
yeah.
Let's see if they've got a reprint colorist. But no, they don't mention that at all.
No, they just
Does anybody know if the classic X-Men issues have been collected in a trade?
I doubt it, because they're reprints.
Well, I think in that case, then, I thought I read something not long ago that they may be going to do that.
So well, it makes sense. I mean,
if they haven't already, then I think it's coming.
There's actually some really good of the backup stories that they had, and in the first number of issues, they interspersed pages like they did right here.
Yeah,
and it was John Bolton doing the artwork, and it's just so gorgeous. I mean, some of it was really good stuff, and some of it was just kind of filler. But it's Claremont filling in little bits and pieces, like you did here.
Yeah, I picked up. I made a case of picking up the classic X-Men issue, which covered issue 111, because they added, as well as they added pages in that. Because in the original 111, the splash page is Beast at the fairground, isn't it? And he's looking at Banshee, who's being the Barker, and all the X-Men are already being shown as fairground attractions, And as a reader, you think, have I missed an issue? What's happening here? And so it kind of deals with how Beast gets to the fairground. And I think there's another extra page somewhere as well. And then in the back of that, Bolton did an extra one about with Mesmero, which shows and explains how they got to that situation of all being captured and put into the fairground. So all of that backstory, which was originally missing, it fills it all in for you.
So they skipped the War Star, or what was his name, the mercenary that snuck into the X-Men.
Warhawk, wasn't it?
Warhawk. They skipped that issue in the classic X-Men reprints.
Did they? I wasn't sure, but I'm not surprised because...
Yeah, because they go right from...
At the time, it was a kind of...
Vindicator or Weapon Alpha attacking Wolverine.
To that. Yeah.
Right to, Mesmero.
Yeah. At the time, it was just like a one-off fill-in, wasn't it? It wasn't meant to connect to anything else. But then later, they said that Warhawk was working for the Hellfire Club.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the artwork was someone else completely different. It wasn't Byrne. It was almost like it was a fill-in story.
Yeah.
And what was that? Was that 110?
I think it was. Was it Tony DeZuniga was the artist, remember rightly.
Well, I'd like to see him ink Byrne. And once again, it's X-Men playing baseball in that one.
Yeah.
I don't know. It could have been a filler. It might not have been. Anyway, all in all, the Alpha Flight story here, it felt better than, just a story to give the X-Men a team that matches them. While Byrne, the Alpha Flight became sort of like the Boba Fett of the Marvel Universe in that, Byrne he says he created them just so they could fight, were on par with the X-Men.
Yeah.
And everybody was just like, oh, we want Alpha Flight. We want Alpha Flight so bad. Mm-hmm. And, Lucas never understood why people thought Boba Fett was so cool, mm-hmm. And Byrne was just like, well, his problem with Alpha Flight was that they were never fleshed out to him. They were never more than just like two-dimensional characters.
Yeah.
Because he never intended for them to be big or popular. And they just... Yeah. Grueling thing.
They were pretty much at this stage. They were pretty much like the Soviet super soldiers. who would be used as and when required by writers. Yeah. And they'd just appear for a battle or whatever, and then that was it. We didn't really know anything more about them. Well, because they were Soviets. but well, that's a similar kind of thing. Alpha Flight was just like a super Soviets thing that they would use, and then you wouldn't see them anymore. That was the original idea. But I think Byrne was a victim of his own genius here, because he obviously made them too interesting. Well, and everybody started to ask for more.
Right. I think he whetted everyone's appetite to the point where they wanted more of this. They weren't kind of just we've all seen those kind of throwaway one-shot villains that will show up in an issue that you don't care about. But this, he peppers in enough facts about them. You don't get any background on them, but they're interesting as superheroes that you want to know more about what's going on, you know?
And especially when some of them get another appearance later in X-Men as well. That kind of cements their position.
Right.
Yeah, I'm looking up something because I just a comparison between things in one issue and the other. Maybe nothing at all. Nothing at all.
Pleased to say that I finally found issue 121 online, which I have just downloaded and I'm scanning right now. Skimming through.
I like the little totem guys that Shaman pulls out of his bag. His bag is much like... Yeah, exactly. Well, I was thinking it's exactly like
Felix.
Felix the cat's bag of tricks.
Yep. You know, we can do whatever he needs can get pulled out of it. And he pulls out these little, they almost look like heads off a totem pole.
Yeah.
And they're like animated wood figures. And then they come out and they're almost like little tiki dolls or something.
You know what it makes me think of? And I don't know why. Maybe Trilogy it's just of Terror? The size of Trilogy of Terror, exactly. Oh my gosh. Yeah, it kind of creeps me out the same way that little guy did. Yeah,
they look like the little whatever that warrior was called.
Oh, the Tiki Warrior.
When that attacked, it's Karen Black, I think, is the person in there.
Yeah.
Man,
you know, there's two scenes in here. One where Northstar attacks Cyclops from behind. He hits him with a fist. And Cyclops' head goes off to the right, and he blasts his optic beam. And then a couple pages later, he determines that Storm is the most powerful one and attacks her. And it's basically the same attack. It's just because the way the panel's done differently, you don't realize it's the same thing. And even her head does the same kind of tilt.
Well, he's drawing him a lot the way they used to draw Quicksilver.
Yeah.
With the speed lines and just kind of a shape.
Yeah, he's always said he's only got limited running poses. So, yeah, it's something to consider there. When, I guess it was the previous issue, though, in 120, when Northstar and Aurora blast Nightcrawler, it's one of the few times you actually see his face in the light. Because normally he's got that self-created shadow.
Which I know in Elsewhen we talked about that Byrne tried to establish that was part of his mutation, that darkness on his face. And I never liked that. It's like, no, that's just the way he's drawn. It's an artistic style. I don't think it's part of his mutation.
Well, I mean, that goes back to Dave Cockrum, who created him. And Cockrum just like kept piling on superpowers on Nightcrawler. I mean, he's got that gymnastic ability. He can stick to walls like Spider-Man. He can disappear in near dark, and he can teleport. I'm sure there's something else that's going to show up.
Don't forget fencing.
Yeah.
I never liked where they said that he can almost becomes invisible in shadow. Just I would believe that he's going to be hard to see in shadow because he's indigo. You know, let's don't forget he's wearing a bright red costume.
Yep.
So, and he's got glowing eyes.
Well, like I said, you look at that one panel and his head is pretty much all gone in the dark relief, you know. And I mean, again, it's just his head that's covered, so that's why it does that. I don't know about you guys. It's a little late for me. I'm getting tired. I think we've got COVID here, so I'm not feeling my best. So I think we ought to wrap this up unless there's something else.
No, I think we've this is a lot of action in this episode issue, you know, and it de-escalates pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. Then of course Wolverine does the little trick of him showing up in the plane. No, I've got faith. That's good.
I found the classic X-Men reprint now, 27, and I see the additional pages that you're talking about being inserted here. That really fleshes it out with the ambassadors and the other officials. Good job.
Yeah. Well done.
I haven't looked. I wonder if those pages are included in the X-Men omnibus.
I don't think they would be.
It's burned in, you know, I don't know.
Even the little coda with Sasquatch and the ripped up van. I mean, that's pretty good. That's pretty nice. I like this. I had not read this before, so I'm impressed. Good choice, Nigel.
That's because, for the longest time, I didn't have issue 121. I could never get it. I don't know what it was, but for some reason, it never came through. Because I had a regular order at the comic shop for X-Men, but he never got sent 121, and I never found it anywhere. So it wasn't until the classic X-Men issue came out that I actually got a copy of it.
That's why I own a lot of classic X-Men, because I could at the time couldn't afford.
Right.
Yeah. The issues. That's why I had them. I could read them.
I mean, I started reading X-Men with 132, and it was very hard to find the older back issues then, because just when I started reading it was when everybody had discovered Byrne and Austin on X-Men, and it was very hard to find them. Of course, we didn't have the comic book shops around at that point in time. But when I turned 16 in 82, I was driving all the comic book shops and it's like, yeah, I'm looking for Byrne X-Men and there's yet. They're like, good luck.
And they were reasonably, at that time when I was collecting, they were reasonably priced. But
yeah, they're just hard to come by.
Compared to now, yeah.
Well, people weren't going into the comic book shops and selling their collections in 82 and, you know, from 82 to 85, it just wasn't happening. 86, all of a sudden, that's when people started thinking, you know, maybe I can pay my way through college with this or.
Good luck.
Yeah. Hey, I actually paid for a semester's tuition and books with comics. I actually bought a car with one comic. And these things are possible.
Yeah.
Still got some books that are worth some salt, though my son says they're now his.
All right. Shall we wrap up then?
I think I think we've kind of covered this well. And I would like to say for our dear listeners, if you've stayed with us this long, if you would like even more information or in depth on this, you can check out our previous episodes of episode 12. And 12.5. Well, now it's just me and Brian talking about these two issues.
In the olden days.
Right. We were early when the show was just getting started.
Almost 10 years ago. Oh, my God.
It is, yeah.
Time is moving so fast.
All right, well, I'll take us out since, Brian, you brought us in.
Okay. Have at
it. Okay. Well, if you want to get a hold of us, you can write us at gottagetburned@gmail.com and let us know if you show suggestions, or if you just want to tell us how we did a coverage or whatever you want to do. Or you can leave us comments on Apple iTunes or Apple Podcast, excuse me.
Yep.
Or probably the best way to get a hold of us is through Facebook, our Facebook page. Just look for Third Degree Burn. That's where we post the show, post teasers and things like that. Other people post links to articles or artwork or anything burn related. So that's the best place to reach out to us. So I would like to thank everybody for listening this long. I want to thank my co-hosts. It's great to have Brian back. He's been sorely missed. So for Third Degree Burn, I am Tim Elliott.
I'm Kirk Greenfield.
I'm Brian Hughes.
And I'm Nigel Spink.
stop fighting us. Please, mon ami, do not force us to do this.
Better listen to the Frenchies, kid fella.
This time, for all our sakes, stay down.
Better get the shackles on him while we still can.
I won't work for you, Vindicator. Why are you doing this?
We don't want you, my old friend. Only the secret you keep inside you.
Thanks for listening. You can find us and many other great shows at tutufreaks.com. That's TWOTRUEFREAKS.com. Third Degree Burn is spelled with the number 3, RDDEGREEBYRNE, and is part of the 22Freaks network of shows. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for Third Degree Burn, spelled with the number 3, and Burn spelled BYRNE. Compliments, complaints, and recipes can be sent to gottagetburned@gmail.com. That's GOTTAGETBYRNED@gmail.com. Drop us a line and tell us how we're doing. Till next time, this has been Third Degree Burn.
Some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burn.